I think the next thing that I want to do is use this concept of outrage to introduce you to the kinds of risk communication. And what we're going to do is we're going to graph hazard against outrage. And I want to point you to the interesting corners of the graph. And we're going to start here in the high hazard, low outrage corner. People are... I can't stand here, right? We're going to have to make some changes in these arrangements during the break because I want to be able to walk around. People are upset. Okay, I'm sorry, people are not upset. People are endangered, but not upset. And I think the examples we talked about earlier were driving and smoking and so forth. And this is the venue of what I call precaution advocacy. And in ways that I hope is clear, given what we've said so far, the very essence of precaution advocacy is to try to increase the outrage. You're not trying to increase the outrage for the fun of it. You're trying to increase the outrage because you understand the causal structure of the system you're working in. You want to increase the outrage in order to increase the hazard perception, in order to increase people's inclination to take precautions or demand that you or someone else take precautions. This is what activists do. This is also what health and safety people do inside the company. And Bruce made reference to that early this morning, that precaution advocacy, if you're trying to alert people to a risk, if you're trying to make people take a risk more seriously, your task is precaution advocacy, and by far the easiest strategy available to you is to increase the outrage. Okay. Now, there are other strategies available to you. My clients will often say to me, I want people to take precautions, but I don't want to scare them. That's a little bit like saying, I want to write a novel, but I don't want to use the letter E. It's a hell of a handicap. But it is, in fact, doable. There have been novels written without the letter E. They weren't very good novels, but, it's doable. But I would certainly try to argue that client out of that position. I would try to argue that scaring them is the single most powerful tool you have for getting them to take precautions, and why would you want to tie one hand behind your back on that task? So the paradigm in precaution advocacy is watch out. This could kill you. Do something. Wear a seatbelt. Wear a hard hat. Wear a condom. Not necessarily all at the same time. We're not going to devote much time today to precaution advocacy. In the very back of your handouts, there are handouts for the model, for the kinds of risk communication we're not focusing on. So you can use those handouts to learn a little bit more about precaution advocacy. And then the bottom of every handout is a section called For More on My Take on This Issue, which steers you to specific URLs on my website. My goal in life is to get everything I know onto my website so that I can retire. I'm getting close. So if you're interested in any aspect of what we're talking about today, including you want to know more about precaution advocacy, you're worried about safety at your facility, you keep spilling uranium into the water and you would like to stop, quite apart from wanting people to be less upset when you do it, you'd also like to do it less. The making people less upset when you do it is an outrage management problem. Doing it less is a precaution advocacy problem. You have to have the employees who are making the errors that make that happen more worried about it. If you're interested in more about precaution advocacy, look in the back at those handouts and then follow those handouts to the relevant sections of my website, and I think you can learn more about it. All I want to do today is to very quickly identify three technical specifications, three out of dozens, for doing good precaution advocacy, just so you get a sense of it. And the first of the tech specs I want to mention is keep it short. Now, why is it particularly important? Why is it particularly important in precaution advocacy, more important in precaution advocacy than any other kind of risk communication, to keep your message short? People don't want to listen. That's exactly right. People are apathetic. A synonym for low outrage is apathy. So down at the bottom, across the bottom here, you've got a situation where people are apathetic. Apathetic people have a short attention span, and you only therefore have a short window of opportunity to talk to them. If you don't keep your message short, you lose them. The second tech spec, which also follows from the fact that they're apathetic, is make it interesting. If you make it interesting, maybe instead of 15 seconds of attention, you can get a whole minute. Then you can cover four times as much stuff. So it's very important in precaution advocacy to make your message interesting. And in fact, as some of you know, safety people very often add to safety meetings content that is only marginally related to safety. You sing songs and you tell riddles and you do all kinds of things that are not strictly safety education, because safety is boring to lots of employees. They have the safety meeting every week and they stop paying attention, and if 30 seconds of irrelevance can get you for 2 or 3 minutes of attention, it's a good investment of the 30 seconds, because you're keeping people awake that much longer, and they're hearing that much more of the safety message. So making it interesting is in some ways important enough that you sacrifice relevance in order to get attention. And then the third tech spec, and I'm only going to cover three, is stay on message. Because you have this very short window of opportunity, you figure out what the best message is for this audience on this issue at this time. You craft your messages, you test them and you wordsmith them and test them some more and wordsmith some more, and you get the very best messages you can, and then you stick to them come hell or high water. Now, those of you with a PR background, this should sound awfully familiar, right? Keep it short, make it interesting, stay on message. That's all PR 101. And there's a very good reason why that's PR 101, because PR and precaution advocacy are grounded in the same assumption, the assumption that you're talking to people who are not interested. PR is all about shoving crap down the throats of people who are not interested. Precaution advocacy is also about that. So people who have good PR skills are automatically going to be good at precaution advocacy. In the opposite corner, wearing the black trunks, outrage management. And this is, of course, the one we're going to focus on today and tomorrow. These are the high outrage, low hazard risks. People are upset, but not very endangered, or at least they are more upset than they are endangered, or at least they are more upset in your opinion than they are endangered, in your opinion. Because it should be obvious, quite often you are doing outrage management about an issue that the Northern Land Council is doing precaution advocacy about. Or you are doing outrage management about an issue that somebody is doing precaution advocacy about. If it's genetically modified food, Monsanto, the one of the main companies that manufactures genetically modified seeds, when Monsanto communicates about the risk of genetically modified food, what kind of risk communication is it doing? Outrage management. When Greenpeace communicates about the risk of genetically modified food, what kind of risk communication is it doing? Precaution advocacy. And they're both doing the right thing, given their opinion. Whether you think their opinion is grounded in who pays their paycheck, or grounded in their ideology, or grounded in data, I will leave that to your judgment. It's, to some extent grounded in all three. But once you're a Greenpeace rep, you're going to be doing precaution advocacy. Once you're a Monsanto rep, you're going to be doing outrage management. And you're playing on the same playing field. If the paradigm of precaution advocacy is watch out, the paradigm of outrage management is calm down. But the message isn't calm down. Why not? Yeah, I mean, calm down is not an outrage-reducing message. What happens to people's outrage when you tell them to calm down? Yeah, they get more outraged. I mean, especially if your tone of voice suggests that your real message is calm down, you hysterical fool. Which is that people don't like that, and the result is more outrage. So calm down is not a very good message, but calming them down is the goal. Okay, in outrage management, or to put that another way, the goal is to reduce the outrage. Okay. For the same reason that the goal in precaution advocacy is to increase the outrage, because you understand the causal structure you're working with. You're trying to reduce the outrage in order to reduce the hazard perception, in order to reduce people's inclination to take precautions or to make you take precautions. Okay. Now, let's look at the three tech specs for precaution advocacy and see how well they work in outrage management. The first one was keep it short. Do you have to keep your message short in outrage management? No. They come to a meeting and stay till midnight. Okay. Instead of a 15-second soundbite, you have a 7-hour meeting. Okay. And then next week, you have another 7-hour meeting. You wish you had to keep your message short. You long for the good old days of apathetic audiences. But in outrage management, brevity is no longer a very important criterion. Second tech spec was make it interesting. Do you want to make the issue interesting in outrage management? No. They're already interested. They are, in fact, obsessed. Okay. And your long-term goal is to make it boring. Now, that doesn't mean you can afford to give a boring speech, because boring speeches aren't boring to outraged people. How do outraged people respond if they come to a meeting, ready to yell at you, and you launch the meeting with 300 PowerPoint slides full of data? Do they get bored? No. What do they get?
Angry.
How dare you waste my time with this crap? This is not what I came here for. So you don't want to bore them, or you can't afford to give a speech that bores them, but it is your goal to make the issue boring. At some future date, you want them to say to themselves, gee, should I go to another meeting about that controversy, or should I stay home and wash the dishes? I think I'll stay home and wash the dishes. It sounds more interesting. Okay. The third tech spec was stay on message. I argued that you figure out what you want to say, and you stick to it in precaution advocacy, come hell or high water. Is that what you do in outrage management? No. Okay. Why do outraged people interact with you? What are their tech specs? What are they trying to accomplish? What do they want to do? They want you to believe them, but long before they get to the question of whether you're going to believe them, what do they want to do? They want to catch you out,
but they
want to stop you doing what you're doing. Those are their goals, certainly. What do they want to do at the meeting? They want to vent. That's the word I was looking for. They want to vent. Okay. Now, they have their own specs. They don't want to vent in a closet. They want to vent in front of you, in front of each other, and in front of journalists. But they come to the meeting to vent, to yell at you, to tell you what a jerk you are. Okay. And nothing useful can be accomplished until they have done some venting. My clients will often ask me, how do we stop the venting? And that's a particularly stupid question. Not because there aren't answers. It's not all that hard to stop the venting. It's just undesirable to stop the venting. You think about a tank of gas under pressure, and you've got a pressure relief valve on that tank in order to relieve the pressure so that you won't explode the tank. And you can take out the PRV. That's not hard. You can plug the PRV, but why would you? Then the tank explodes. So if there's a lot of pressure, you want the PRV to bleed off the pressure. And I would argue that venting gas from a tank under pressure is very much like venting outrage. In both cases, you're better off venting it than letting it explode the tank in one case and explode the community in the other case. So if people need to vent, you have an interest in letting them vent. So they come to the meeting to vent, and you come to the meeting to listen while they vent. Active listening, you're not allowed to read a book. You take notes, you murmur, you nod your head, you do all the things you have learned how to do if you've taken a course in active listening. in order to not just listen, but communicate that you are in fact listening. And as you listen and they vent, what happens? Yeah, they run out of steam, at least temporarily. They get calmer. Okay? It's not a permanent solution. Whatever's creating the outrage is still there. But you have vented some of it. And as they get calmer, a very interesting thing happens. They start wanting to hear from you. And start out wanting to hear from you. They started out wanting to shout at you. But if you are listening and listening and listening, eventually they start to wonder what you're thinking. Okay? And someone will ultimately get in your face and say, well, what have you got to say for yourself? You're sitting there like a bump on a log. You've been taking notes. You've been murmuring, uh-huh. You haven't said a word for 3 hours. What do you think? Now, that's a watershed. You wait for that to happen. There is no point in talking to people. I mean, you can do your safety share and tell them where the bathrooms are. But there's no point in talking meaningfully, talking about substantive controversial issues to people until they ask you to. If they come to vent, you should come to listen, and you should not try to talk until they ask you to. And the first time they ask you to, demur. You know, gee, I think it's premature. There are people who haven't spoken yet. I'm learning so much this evening. Try not to let that sound sarcastic. And little by little, the room reunites behind the premise that it's your turn. And you wait for that. You wait for people to shush each other, you know, on the grounds that it's your turn. She listened to you. Okay, now it's time for us to listen to her. And you wait for that to happen. Okay, and now finally it happens. It's your turn to talk. Now do you pull out your PowerPoint slides? No. When, you know, when it's finally your turn to talk, what's the most important thing to say? I've heard what you said. Now be careful. You don't want to say, I know how you feel. That's good for another hour of venting. So you don't want to say that. And even I've heard what you said is maybe a little arrogant, maybe a little presumptuous. I would tend to make it a question. Let me see if I've heard you right. I've been listening very carefully. And if I'm hearing you right, there are three things that I keep hearing again and again this evening. A lot of people are angry that we did X. A lot of people are worried that Y might happen. And a lot of people are really anxious to make sure we're going to do Z. Okay. But still, you know, you can see the structure of this interaction. Early in the interaction, they get to tell you what a jerk they think you are. Later in the interaction, you get to tell them what a jerk they think you are. Okay? At neither point do you get to tell them what a jerk you think they are. Okay? Because that wouldn't manage their outrage well. Now, this is counterintuitive. This is not natural. The natural thing to do when someone is venting at you, when you finally get the floor, is to vent back, right? There's a reason why they founded a religion on the basis of turn the other cheek. Because it doesn't come naturally. When someone is venting at you, typically, there are three kinds of content. Some of what they're saying is valid grievances. Some of what they're saying has a germ of truth, but it's grossly exaggerated. And some of what they're saying is crap. Do we all agree all three of those are going to be in the message when they're venting at you? Now, if you're a normal person, okay, and you're following your own inclination, when you finally get your chance to talk, which of those three kinds of content will you respond to? The crap. The natural thing to do when you finally get the floor is to say, that's crap. And you pick three things they said that actually are crap, and you rebut the crap. Okay? You ignore the valid grievances. You ignore the concerns that are partly valid and partly exaggerated, and you rebut the crap. Whose outrage are you managing? Your own. Okay. If you want to manage their outrage instead of yours, you ignore the crap, and you focus on validating the valid grievances. Now, don't validate the crap. Okay, I don't want anyone to get the impression that I think it's good outrage management to tell people they're right about things you think they're wrong about. It's not sustainable. Okay. Nor is it good outrage management to tell people they're wrong about things you think they're wrong about. It is good outrage management to say as little as possible early in the relationship about the things you think they're wrong about, and focus on some of the things you can say honestly. They have a point. They're right. Yes, it's true. You're right about this historical point. You're right about that one. You're right about what we screwed up last week. And then the more things they're complaining about that you can validate, the more you build up a relationship grounded in lower outrage that will enable you eventually to begin to talk about the crap. Now, somewhere, even early on, somewhere you have to rebut the crap. If you don't rebut the crap anywhere, you leave the impression that you have validated the crap. So every organization should have a crap rebuttal corner of its website. It's not usually called crap rebuttal. It's usually called frequently asked questions. Okay. But that's where you get to say, a lot of people think X, but the truth is Y. Okay. And you should do that. I'm not saying don't do crap rebuttal. I am saying don't waste precious face time with hostile stakeholders on crap rebuttal. Do it in some much more routine venue, and in this precious interaction with hostile stakeholders, do outrage management instead, which is the opposite of crap rebuttal. Now, is it clear?
Peter?
Yes.
I just want to say that not only does the website often call the crap rebuttal frequently asked questions, they also often call it myths about such and such, which is a sort of an insulting way to frame crap rebuttal.
So yeah, you may as well say crap rebuttal if you're going to say myths.
Myths about vaccines, or myths about pollution and the extent of the plume. And so that's automatically an insulting way to frame the crap rebuttal.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine how you would feel if people call your cherished opinions myths, which I intend to do before the end of the day, but not yet. Okay, is it clear that outrage management and precaution advocacy are very different skill sets? You can be good at both of them. You can be a good carpenter and a good electrician, but you need two toolkits. And you need a diagnostic capability of determining when you have an outrage management problem and when you have a precaution advocacy problem. And, if you hammer nails into electrical circuits, you are going to make things worse. And in exactly the same way, if you do precaution advocacy in an outrage management environment, you are going to make things worse. If you do outrage management in a precaution advocacy environment, you are going to make things worse. So you need to know whether you're trying to calm down people who are unduly upset or trying to upset people who are unduly calm. And the set of skills that you use for one will do you nothing but harm in the other venue. So, particularly if you're trained in PR, PR people can be good at outrage management, but not if they do PR in an outrage management environment, because PR is a set of skills much more comparable with precaution advocacy. Up here in the upper right-hand corner, we have a third paradigm, high hazard, high outrage. People are upset, and they're right to be upset because the hazard is genuinely high. This is the venue of crisis communication. Okay. Somebody give me an example of some crisis situations that you may face, or even that anyone may face. What are some crises, high hazard, high outrage situations? BP oil spill was certainly high hazard, high outrage. Give me another one.
Plane crash,
absolutely. Infectious disease outbreak. Obviously a major explosion or a major spill at any of your facilities, a tailings impoundment collapse. But also a plant closing, or a mine closing is high hazard, high outrage, even though it's not high hazard to health, it's high hazard to employment. And people are upset that they're going to lose their jobs, and they're right to be upset that they're going to lose their jobs. And it's certainly not useful in that situation to go in and tell them not to be upset, because they're correct to be upset. It's not effective and it's not honorable to try to reduce outrage in crisis situations. The two mistakes that organizations most often make, the big mistake they make in an outrage management environment is to act as if it were a precaution advocacy environment, and the biggest mistake, and talk in sound bites. And the big mistake they make in a crisis environment is to talk as if it were an outrage management problem and try to calm people down. Okay. Calming people down is the job in outrage management. It is not the job in crisis communication. They are rightly upset, and you need them to be upset so that they will take precautions. Okay. But there's still communicating to be done. There's no arrow to draw. We're not trying to increase the outrage. We're not trying to decrease the outrage. But there's still communicating to be done. We've already got the outrage commensurate with the hazard. That's always one goal in risk communication, to get the outrage commensurate with the hazard. In precaution advocacy, that means getting it higher. In outrage management, that means getting it lower. In crisis communication, that goal is already met. Okay? And now you have other goals. You are trying to help people bear their outrage. And then you are trying to help them harness their outrage and make wise rather than unwise decisions. This is a third toolkit. The paradigm in precaution advocacy is watch out. The paradigm in outrage management is calm down. The paradigm in crisis communication is we'll get through this together. The cardinal sin in crisis communication is to tell people to calm down. Because, you know, they're rightly upset, and you don't want to tell them not to be upset. You want to help them bear how upset they are, and then you want to guide them so that their high outrage motivates wise precautions rather than unwise precautions. If you're interested in crisis communication, again, in the back, there are handouts on crisis communication that will steer you to crisis communication parts of the website. But the main point I want to make about crisis communication is don't use outrage management skills when you're doing crisis communication. Don't use outrage management skills when you're doing precaution advocacy. Don't use precaution advocacy or crisis communication skills when you're doing outrage management. You need three toolkits. And the toolkit we're focusing on today is the outrage management toolkit. Down here, low hazard, low outrage. I'm not going to draw a circle. I have not found that to be a business opportunity. I earn my living in the other three corners of the map. Just to test your understanding of capitalism, which of the other three corners do you think pays best? Outrage management, absolutely. And crisis communication pays considerably less well than outrage management, and precaution advocacy pays considerably less well than crisis communication. And I try to divide my time as close to evenly as I can so that I can look at an audience like this one and say, you are subsidizing my work on precaution advocacy, which indeed you are. Now, when I say if you're down in this corner, there's no communicating to be done, I hope that's obvious. I mean, you know, people are apathetic about something that's insignificant. They got it right. What have you got to say to them? You know, congratulations on your apathy. You're absolutely right, this is trivial. You know, there's very little risk communication to be done. Now, that's only true if they're there temporarily. If they're there permanently. If they're there temporarily, you know, if you anticipate that there's going to be outrage, but there isn't yet, you may want to do some proactive, preemptive outrage management. If you anticipate that there's going to be hazard, but there isn't yet, you may want to do some proactive, preemptive precaution advocacy. If you anticipate there's going to be both, then you're in the venue of pre-crisis communication, you know, warning them about an upcoming crisis and trying to prepare them for that crisis. So it's certainly possible down here that, you know, if you're down here in, you know, temporarily, that you've got risk communication work to do. But if you're down there permanently, you don't have risk communication work to do. And finally...
Peter?
Yes?
You've said 90% of what I think is important about the lower left-hand corner, but I think it's not just if you know that there's going to be outrage, you have to surveil for issues that you don't have any idea about. And this is where incoming communication from community members or employees who work in the community can let you know that people are starting to get upset about something. So you have to do active surveillance in this area for issues that aren't on your radar screen yet, but that you probably have some good access to data about.
I'm sorry?
Spend a fair bit of time at home in that bottom box down there.
Yeah. In the middle is the sweet spot. Hazard is high enough that it's worth your while to talk to people. It's low enough that you have time to talk to people. Outrage is high enough that they're interested and low enough that they're not freaking out. And this is real risk communication in the sweet spot, but it's easy. Okay. People listen respectfully. They ask good questions. They learn data. The sweet spot is the place where the most data gets communicated. In precaution advocacy, you don't have long enough to communicate much data because they're not that interested. In outrage management, they don't trust the data. You have to give it to them or they'll be more outraged that you didn't. But you don't actually expect them to believe the data that dimethyl meatloaf doesn't cause leukemia. In crisis communication, you have more important things to do with them than communicate the data. You have to get right to the bottom line. But in the sweet spot, lots of data get communicated. Okay, this is the map. Anytime you face a risk communication problem, the first thing you do is figure out where am I on the map? How high do I think the hazard is? How high do I think the outrage is? And then put a time element in there. How high do I think the hazard is going to be soon? How high do I think the outrage is going to be soon? And based on your answers to those four questions, you know where you are on the map, and you know which toolkit you need to use. You don't do that just once. You do it periodically. Every time you're talking to a new audience, you need to reconsider whether you're in the same place on the map. Every time the issue changes, you need to consider whether you're in the same place on the map. This is short term. Crises, for example, normally start as precaution advocacy before the crisis. They become crisis communication during the crisis. You have to do a lot of outrage management after the crisis. There's sort of a normal progression of crises, through all three boxes. But you got to keep looking to see where you are. Other comments?
I think another important consideration is understanding who the audience is, because sometimes you get blindsided to think you're in the middle with the smiley face, but there's actually a group of people or a person that you didn't even know existed in the situation as such, and all of a sudden they're in the zone and you're up into outrage management before you know it.
It's a very good point. There are lots of times when it looks to you like you're in the sweet spot, and you are in the sweet spot vis-a-vis the people you're talking to. But there are other people you're not talking to whose outrage is mushrooming, and you're not aware of them. And I mean, you framed this as you're getting blindsided. To some extent, you're blindsiding yourself. You don't want to be aware of them because you're having a nice time in the sweet spot. And it would make your life much more unpleasant to have to deal with Susan. So it's not that you don't know that Susan exists. It's that Susan's a pain in the ass. And you keep imagining that Susan's not part of the system because, you and your consultation committee are getting along just fine, and Susan would screw that up. Sometimes you missed it, and sometimes, you tried to miss it because you didn't want to deal. But it's the same problem either way. You're imagining yourself to be in the sweet spot while this cancer is metastasizing. And you need to reassess your map and notice that some outrage is desperately needed with some stakeholders you haven't been talking to at all. Other comment? Yes. Absolutely. The question is it possible that you have more than one map operating at the same time? You certainly would have different maps for different issues, but as in your example, you may have different maps for the same issue with regard to different stakeholders. So you're talking to the traditional owners, and maybe with the traditional owners, the problem is outrage management, but with people 20 miles away, you're in the sweet spot. Or alternatively, you may have a good relationship going with the traditional owners, and you're neglecting to talk to the people in the town. And they're outraged that you're selling the store to the traditional owners. So that can play out either way. But certainly, you may need more than one map, not just for different issues, but even for the same issue. Comment.
Can you deal with someone that is outraged but might not have any influence on the business?
Okay, the very good question. The question is, how do you deal with someone who is, you know, maybe outraged, may indeed be very outraged, but they're powerless. They have no impact on the business. Okay. And there are two answers to that. The straightforward business answer is high outrage that's impotent. You know, what do you care? It's not, it doesn't add to the cost of doing business. And you know, ignore it. You know, I mean, and then I'll come in and I'll help them become more powerful. We'll do more precaution advocacy. We'll win over allies. We'll win over the media. And eventually we'll get powerful enough that you can't afford to ignore us. But there's a good case to be made that if you think we're powerless and you think we're going to stay powerless, then our outrage is not a cost of doing business. Okay. That's the first half of the answer, or maybe that's the first piece of the answer. But the bigger piece of the answer is you're far likelier to guess that wrong than to guess it right. Low-power people have their own kind of power. You know, they have the power of moral example, you know, for instance. And NGOs, international NGOs, consciously go looking for oppressed low-power people to champion. And then you've got, you know, those people whose outrage you ignored because they were powerless, and now their way has been paid to your AGM, and they are torturing you under the sponsorship of an international NGO, and suddenly it looks like a very bad decision to treat them as not having an impact on your business. So I mean, my sense is it is so likely that people's outrage will eventually be empowered that, you know, it's good business to see essentially all outrage as a potential threat to your business. Even so, the change in the 40 years or so that I've been doing business, that I've been trying to help companies like yours manage outrage, the dominant change is the cost of outrage has gone up. Okay? Whereas the cost of outrage management has gone up much less. I mean, I have raised my fees, but the cost of outrage management has gone up, you know, very slowly. The cost of outrage has gone up hugely. Okay, the globalization of NGOs, for example, has greatly increased the cost of outrage.